SiriusXM Sports presents
At the Races with Steve Bick.
Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
A very good Wednesday, race fans. Still digging out, I think, in a number of places from the big snow. Parks canceled already for today. I think Glenn Kozak explained that once you get more than 4 inches, I think, of snow, that you can't harrow it into the racetrack. I think it's 4 inches. So you gotta plow it, and you know the temperatures, if it doesn't melt. So no parks today, but you do get a big but. You do get the option with fairgrounds running today. So there's swap one in fairgrounds with the Wednesday card. And while I'm looking, Gulfstream at Tampa, Wednesday, of course, and Delta, Mahoning Valley, Turf Paradise, as far as we know, Penn and Charlestown. So 1, 2, 3, eight venues on this Wednesday as things begin to pick back up, and tomorrow start to add Oaklawn, first Thursday of racing. And I was looking at that, looking ahead a little bit, and Aqueduct too, with a Thursday slate. And actually there was news, and there's going to be more news. I don't know, maybe I should save this for tomorrow, because I think Pat McKenna is going to visit, and Naira announced in advance of tomorrow, and I'm sure Pat, you know, will flesh this out too, that change to the Empire Six, Naira's going to continue. Same way, daily force. So the jackpot provision tabled, continues to be tabled. And they're continuing to evaluate, but apparently they were pretty happy with the January results. And there's some more that we'll touch on tomorrow with PMAC, Pat McKenna. And actually, I mentioned that piece about that Bob Ehalt did about the vaccination centers at both Belmont and Aqueduct. And Pat, I'm sure, will have a little something on that, too. There's a bunch of things I can do here in advance of some visits, but we got to talk and maybe listen to the call if I can. I didn't send it to Casey, but I'll try to play it off of the phone. As much fun as we had with Groundhog Day, I don't know if I was on the air or if it caught my eye later on, after we got off the air. Because I think if I'd seen it while we were on the air, I would have mentioned it. Because you can't make it up. you know where I'm headed here, right? Here, let's let me see if I can.
Punxsutawney Phil and Ben Robinson. Joe Mont's trying to come back at Punxsutawney Phil. Clear White Light and Party Business are next as they go towards the fish. Punxsutawney Phil from Joe Mont. Punxsutawney Phil beats Joe Mont. Tight third, Party Business and Clear White Light.
You got to be kidding. A four-year-old yesterday at Newcastle, and the owner is a huge fan of Groundhog Day. And he names this horse Punxsutawney Phil, apparently a big, lopey type that was just not ready to run last year as a three-year-old, the owner breeder, Dan Gilbert, and Brian Ellison trains. And it just, the horse debuts on February 2nd. You just, right? It's a Ripley's believe it or not moment. It's just hysterical. You cannot make this up. The greatest unscripted drama in all of sports. They said it was completely coincidental that the way this happened. And he wins. You know, I mean, it would have been cute and entertaining, just funny that you know, if he had run and, you know, Punxsutawney Phil, a winner on Groundhog Day, right? How great is that? I did see a number of you in what is an increasing cultish tradition took in the film yesterday. I snuck in a few while Tina ended up having to go out, not had to go out, but she did go out. We, you know, the snow was supposed to be done by like 5 a.m. yesterday, and instead it just lingered and lingered and lingered, and we ended up, I don't know if there was more than almost as much as, I don't know, 7-8 inches when it finally relented. So she went out at one point, so I snuck in about 20 minutes of Groundhog Day. Because the only thing that's been on the television in this house for 4 days, what was yesterday, Tuesday? The only thing that's been on is this, she discovered Yellowstone? Anybody? Out of nowhere? Kevin Costner is this Montana rancher patriarch with, you know, it's got sort of, I don't know, it's got sort of elements. It's got a little bit of everything. It's got a little Lonesome Dove in it, and a little bit of Deadwood, and a little bit of Dallas or Dynasty. It's pretty crazy. I guess there's been 3 seasons. She's literally watched it nonstop since I think Saturday or Sunday. And I got to admit, I mean, I've kind of breezed in and out. It's quite good. Yellowstone. I guess at Paramount Television, I have no idea where it came from. Tina said the only reason she noticed it was because some people are worried that Costner is bowing out after 3 seasons. I don't know. But I got to say, it's quite good. It's quite good. If I go out of the room and go print something and do something and come back, I do say to Tina, what did I miss? So I guess it's got me a little interested too. Yellowstone. That there's your TV push. Now, speaking of episodic TV and series, some unbelievably exciting news for friend of the game and friend and acquaintance of countless people from Hot Springs. If you didn't see it yesterday, and I should maybe even get David back. When Dave Hill visited 2 weeks ago, his traditional pre-Oak Lawn visit, and we were celebrating, you know, the success of the Vapors, and I kind of was, you know, pressing him to see where things stood about, you know, the potential for it to be adapted, essentially, for, you know, these days, everything's television, quote unquote, whether it's theatrical filmmaking or not. But yesterday afternoon, David, kind of tongue in cheek, put out a tweet and said, I wonder who's going to play my father. Congratulations to David, who has signed a production deal to have the Vapors turned into a series. And just as we were kind of hinting, and obviously, you know, David was kind of, I wouldn't say he didn't cold water the question when I asked and probed, but, you know, I knew that it was something that, you know, he was hoping for, and I didn't realize how far along the conversations were and how close he was to making a deal. And from Deadline, I haven't seen anything at Hollywood Reporter yet, but I'm sure it'll turn up today. In a competitive situation, meaning David had several parties interested, Jessica Rhodes, pace setter, and Alexander Tsakelos, Serrata Global, have secured the rights to David Hill's praised 2020 book, The Vapors, for television, with the loudest voice executive producer showrunner Alex Metcalf attached to pen the series adaptation. And what's interesting about this is Metcalf, because they say that he has a tie to Hot Springs, and you know, this is something that he was excited about as well. So we'll get David to talk more, but it's really pretty exciting. And there's, for those of you that watched it, the Amy Adams HBO piece, that Sharp Objects, that's the team behind Sharp Objects. So this clearly has got some gravitas. Congratulations to David. I mean, it's really exciting. And, you know, everything that he put into it, to have this as a, you know, as a next step and a, and the thing, I mean, the thing is sweeping. So it you're talking about a really, you know, potentially something that could run for, you know, multiple seasons. Just great. So when you see Dave on, yesterday he was complaining. It's funny. He tweeted late in the day. He said, I've done nothing but shovel snow all day. I was going to tweet back, shovel snow. You signed a production deal to have the Vapors turn that. I would think that counts as a pretty good, day, no matter how much snow he had to dig out of. So, and when you see Dave on Twitter, make sure you, or Facebook, make sure you congratulate him. Dave Hill, 77, and the Vapors. So for those of you that have been too lazy to buy the book or too lazy to read it, you can maybe you can wait a couple of years for it to show up on. We'll see. You would think that, you know, with those connections that HBO might could end up with it, or, you know, what's the difference now? I mean, there's so much. I don't know. I don't know how you guys keep track, to be honest. I mean, Tina, I can't even move the TV between cable and the you know, this carousel of channels or networks that the smart TV has. You know, Tina got a whatever that thing is, the box that, is it Alexa? I don't even know who it is. But it turns the TV on and stuff. And there's like, there must be 50 things at the bottom of the screen. So I'm lucky. I'm lucky if I can get the cable to the local channels to even just pop up. Source, you hit source, and then I was never any good at that when it comes to that, to the TV. A few things. Charlie Hayward back today, and we'll talk to Charlie in about 10 minutes. And we're going to, as I said, we're going to continue to delve into his piece from Thoroughbred Racing Commentary. And we're going to parse out and drill down on, you know, both sides of the discussion, the ADW and the CAW, the computer assisted wagering, or CRW. And I think Charlie's going to concentrate today somewhat on the sort of overarching topic of the takeout equation and, you know, how much can be solved toward, you know, growing the business, just, you know, just by offering a you know, better pricing, and what the challenges are to, you know, convince, you know, obviously management to some extent, and, you know, I think management's aware But there's also the, you know, the pressures of the revenue and how the revenue is derived. So a little bit on that topic today, and then we'll keep, you know, we'll keep folding in segments until we, you know, until we really, I don't want to say exhaust the subject because you really can't exhaust the subject, but until, you know, everybody, you know, feels like they've learned more and, you know, a course of action, you know, might be out there. They're just trying to get this discussion, you know, to be public and, you know, for the players, you know, to know. I think one of the biggest frustrations that we all have as players is the perception that industry leadership and racetrack management is oblivious to this, and that, you know, and certainly there's been missteps. I mean, the knee jerk reaction in some, you know, cases, and for many years it was a knee jerk that, revenue's off, let's raise takeout. And that nobody's getting away with that anymore. And, you know, there's been a whole generation, really, you know, a good extended period where the introduction of new wagers have specifically gone out of their way to be priced aggressively. You know, the pick five essentially became, you know, which was, you know, a new entity really. And, you know, that has been co-opted as a well-priced offering. So some takeout conversation with Charlie in this first hour. Sid Fernando, of course, Sire Watch Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill & Dale. We'll talk about the 2 3-year-old winners. And, of course, you know, when it comes to Medina Spirit, you know, the Protonico, here's Medina Spirit, you know, elevating Protonico. And on the, you know, obviously, when it comes to Shug's winner, to greatest honor, it's, you know, you're talking about as elite a pedigree as you could possibly create. In you know, a daughter of Better Than Honor by Tappet, a Tappet colt. So, well, let Sid riff on that. And I do want, I asked Sid to talk about the topic that kind of inadvertently came up during yesterday's tribute to John Forbes. And I heard from several people that were either you know, New Jersey based and bet on John's horses for years, or came across John and you know, in one way or another, that, you know, we're really appreciative. And it's always the case whenever we get to spend time remembering and honoring, you know, stakeholders and horsemen, owners, players, everybody that, you know, that makes the game, you know, brings it together. And in fact, one name that I didn't even realize, John Parada yesterday was talking about the Ragazin team, and, you know, John training for them. Well, Jerry Brown, there, it just so happens, the timing kind of interesting. The America's Best Racing has a Q&A with Jerry Brown that dropped yesterday. And on Jerry's board at Thoroughgraph.com, you know, somebody said, oh, you know, I saw the Jerry, I saw the Q&A. And in addition to just acknowledging, and it's kind of things that you already know about Jerry and his background. But on the board, in because of the Q&A, he actually talked about his association with John Forbes. And, you know, obviously because of Ragazin and Len Friedman, and, you know, Jerry, you know, was aware when he went out on his own of Forbes too. And started to have John train for him. So I would get Jerry to add to the chorus of appreciations for Forbes, but it's rare that Jerry gets up before about 11:30. So those of you, maybe if you send him a, if you've got Jerry in your phone and you're listening, send him a text. Tell him that Vic wants him to. It's tough enough to get Jerry to visit ever, because he's shockingly media shy. But it's also tough because we're on 9 to noon. A tea time will get Jerry. Once in a while, a tea time will get Jerry out of bed. Anyway, as part of that conversation yesterday, it occurred to me that the timing was good for Sid to riff on that family of Tale of the Cat. And I mentioned in passing, the dam of Tale of the Cat was a full sister of Preach, the dam of Pulpit. And Yarn may have been the first foal out of the dam, or second. Narrate is the name of the dam. And what's amazing is Narrate had, I think, 8 or 9 babies, and she only had 2 fillies. The rest were colts. She had 2 fillies. Think about this. Full sisters, Preach, who got Pulpit, and Yarn, who got Tale of the Cat. And there was also a sister as well. There's a sister of Tale of the Cat named Spun Out of Control. And she's the dam of FedBiz, among others, and Spun Silk, who got Joking, the Vosburgh winner. And it's a really interesting story, and I'm sure Sid particularly really given Pulpit and Tale of the Cat's stud careers. I mean, this is obviously a family that Sid has worked with and undoubtedly recommended to clients for years. But it's amazing. She has 2 fillies, and they both become historically significant broodmares. I mean, again, you can't make it up. It's pretty funny. So I'll let Sid riff on that. Andy Serling as well in hour 3. We'll catch up with Seth. I'm sure he's got some Gulfstream and or Tampa to look at. And I've got Ed. I think I got to move Ed up to maybe the 10:30. But John Sakura might slip into that 10:30 slot too, if it works for John. So otherwise, tomorrow for Sakura. So we've got a fun 3 hours. Casey, you could reach for Charlie. We won't take a break. And we'll talk to Charlie here in the next minute or two. Let me mention a couple of just things that happened yesterday. I told you, parks canceled. Keeneland announced the spring schedule yesterday. If you didn't see it, and little tighter on the purses, but not significant cuts, and the usual exciting spring. 2 plus 3 weeks of action. Starts April 2nd. And they don't have, Shannon Arvin said that they have not determined yet how they're going to work the ticket options. They're watching the protocols, and they hope in the next couple of weeks. So when that happens, we'll find out what's going on. We also will, get a hold of Jim Goodman and see, what his plans are for the grade one gamble, if that's going to be online, or, maybe they can take some reservations possibly. So the Keeneland schedule. And of course, if you haven't looked ahead to the Triple Crown prep season, the first Saturday in April, you're looking at the Wood, of course, and Santa Anita Derby, but it'll be Bluegrass Ashland Day. April 3rd at Keeneland. And always a fabulous other than Breeders' Cup and Triple Crown Saturdays, that April the first Saturday in April may be the best in a lot of ways, may be the best race day. And you remember, the Bluegrass used to run that card on the second Saturday. I mean, you go back even further. They'd run it 2 weeks out from the Derby. But when they moved, when Keeneland moved Bluegrass Saturday to that first Saturday joining Santa Anita and Aqueduct, that really, really made the day just spectacular. We obviously are tracking the HHR legislation, and as mentioned yesterday, it was being introduced. Senate Bill 120 by State Senator Schickel and Senate President, too, Robert Stevers. And we'll keep tabs. Tomorrow, 11 a.m., is a hearing, and we'll go from there. Senate doesn't appear to be an issue. It's the Kentucky House that is going to be a little more contentious. So everybody, I don't know if you saw, there's been a parade of, of voices of horsemen and stakeholders around the Bluegrass, being appropriately, vocal and supportive. So that's got the governor's support, et cetera. I know they're saying, well, the outer reaches away from, Louisville and Lexington and away from the breeding community, Northern Kentucky, of course, with Turfway. And you look at, there isn't any part of the state that doesn't benefit, down in the southwest, corner with Kentucky Downs. You've got this Oak Grove project. You've got, or not just a project, it's a track on the harness side. Then you've got the harness project out in eastern Kentucky that's coming, that can come to fruition. So it's hard to believe that there isn't support statewide to get this done. 60,000 jobs involved. So best of luck to everybody's state senator and others that are working to get the HHR legislation done. Somebody who can appreciate what goes on in a state capital setting, Charlie Hayward, back with us for a second visit to follow up from his thoroughbred racing commentary piece from 10 days ago. To ensure the future of U.S. racing industry, the betting business has to change, and we're going to continue to flesh it out and drill it down. Charlie, good morning.
Morning, Steve. Good to be with you.
Appreciate it. And, for the most part, last week's introduction discussion last Thursday got, well received. There's always going to be, certain views of these discussions that don't meet certain people's expectation or desire to have things presented. But, our goal here, as it's always been when I used to do these with Satish too, is to, get these conversations out in the open. And, shining a light on this, whether it's the, computer wagering and, how much is too much and the unfair, potentially unfair advantages. Then, as you really stressed and we'll touch on today, the ADW, the inverted pyramid. You also, I saw, responded on the takeout topic as, really a umbrella that touches on all of this.
Correct. And by the way, if we didn't have differences of opinion, Steve, we wouldn't have horse races and betting. So differences of opinion can be fine as long as is people are civil and well-intended in their comments.
Well, and there's, you know, I refuse to believe that that anybody that listens and anybody that is interested in this topic can't appreciate the opportunity to, you know, give this a wider audience, give these discussions, you know, the specifically when it comes to the computer groups and also really to the ADW structure, these are two topics that have not made agendas at the various, you know, conclaves, whether it's symposium, whether it's whether it's the Jockey Club roundtable, you know, because they're thorny issues.
Yeah, they're thorny issues, and they are very much loaded in favor of the rebaters. If Steve, if you don't mind, I'll just go back and take a minute or two.
Sure.
And because one of the people that wrote in on the column just sort of reduced it to some simple facts, which is that, you know, Hayward's really pointing to the fact that we need to have a reduced takeout for the regular bettor. You know, horse racing blends to about 20%, give or take the track or whatever. We got sports betting now growing like a weed all over the country, and depending on what kind of bets you make, but it's more like in the 5 or 6% range. So that alone is a huge problem. Then we have the ADWs. ADWs came into being as a part of simulcasting. And people decided they would, just like they did with simulcasting, the account wagering business. And Charlie Ruma, you know, from Ohio, was the first guy to really do it in a big way. I mean, we didn't have, the first internet bet was made in 1999 in Illinois. And even by 2002, the total handle on internet wagering, account wagering, was $200 million. Well, now we know it's well over half, certainly this year. So, but people are still selling their signals for 3 to 6%, and it's further complicated by the fact that a lot of these big tracks, the good tracks, are selling their signal, but they're also controlling the ADWs. But just to finish up, the other thing we tackle a little bit, and I'm trying to summarize this because it gets to the heart of the issues: reduce takeout, get the pricing reset to give the better a fairer shot of the ADW business. But the real big number are the rebaters. And in my article, I went back to the only report that's really been done on wagering in America, and it goes back to an NTRA report in 2003 that was published in 2004. And here's some numbers. These are just four of what were then the larger rebaters. And rebaters, as I'm sure most of you, our listeners here, know, is they tend to be big bettors, elite, Turf Club, which is probably the largest now, does well over $1 billion a year. But they took four different rebaters, and their handle was $415 million. That's obviously much bigger today. $169 million, 132,000 pounds, so obviously a non-U.S. Rebater, and then $83 million. And, Steve, the effective takeout, in other words, what these rebaters got back, you know, normally if it was a $100 bet, you'd get back $80, the 20% takeout. Well, these rebaters, their effective takeout rates were 3.8%, 5.2%, 0.5%, and 6.2%. And who do you think subsidized those takeout rates? You know, you and me walking up to the window or going to our computer to make a bet. And we just can't have that. These guys are taking anywhere from raising the takeout to the rest of the bettors anywhere from 2 to up to as much as 5%.
Exactly.
So I just thought I'd set the frame a little bit and we can go from there.
Absolutely. And, you know, and with that inclusion, I can hand it to you, Charlie, and let you, you know, kind of riff on your thoughts, or I can offer, you know, kind of an entree, by asking when track management is assessing this topic, and you know, the whether it's, you know, through introduction of new wagers, or whether it's, you know, just the entire landscape of, you know, of the wagering pricing, what, you know, what has been the thinking, and, you know, how conscious can players be, how, you know, how confident, rather, can players be that track management is trying to get to competitive pricing? Are, you know, do you sense that that they're aware, acutely aware of the vulnerability the game has, you know, vis-a-vis what is going to be, you know, a complete change in you know, the wagering opportunities across the country, with sports betting taking on whatever, you know, whatever formats it's going to take on?
Well, I'd say a couple of things. One is, and, you know, I was one of those track managers. As you know, I was at Niagara for 8+ years. And, but I was a bettor. I grew up as a bettor. I didn't go to track until, June 1st, 1980, and from June 1st, 1980 to 1981, I went 67 times, so I sort of made up for some lost times. But one criticism I would have in general about track operators is they don't understand betting. Well, what does that mean? Well, when you're in a parimutuel situation and someone bets $100, the track takes off their takeout rates, whatever it was, an exactor or a win bet or whatever, that'll blend to about 20%. And they give $80 back to the people that cash the tickets. So, you know, historically, I don't think that tracks were, you know, didn't require them to know a lot about betting. Now, if you're a bookmaker in the UK, you don't know betting, you don't stay in business very long. So, but it's gotten further complicated now because, I mentioned Elite Turf Club, the largest rebater. It's owned by the Stronach Group. Most people don't know that. And they clearly know a lot about betting. And also the Stronach Group has ExpressBet. And I'm not saying these are negative, but I think there needs to be much, much, much more disclosure of takeout rates, effective takeout rates. You know, what are these big rebaters getting? What's the effective rate for them? You know, what's interesting, the rise of the rebaters, and certainly the ADW business, goes back to, as I said, the early 2000s. And it's no coincidence, in 2003, we hit an all-time record of handle. I think it was 15.3 or 15.2 billion. And this year, we were lucky that it clawed up a little bit, and we're just a little bit under $11 billion. Well, any business that loses, you know, 25-plus percent, you know, over a 20-year period is not a healthy business. And that's really the point here. That there's got to be a reset of the economics, and the only way you're going to get people to think about this and look at it is if they have the facts. And right now, Steve, you and I would have a hard time, you know, clawing and scratching to get information on any aspect of betting from a racetrack.
On that, in fact, it's funny you bring this up, and it's certainly a topic specifically that doesn't get, again, doesn't get much of a public airing. But Charlie, explain those accountings and the CRIMS numbers and how, you know, how available those are. It was something, and nobody's really picked up on it. In, you know, the piece prints out to 9 pages. So there's tons of things in here. But one thing you do mention is the, you know, the transparency, or even, you know, just the ability to delve into the numbers, to understand where things are. Explain how those numbers are disseminated, and you know, who's controlling them, and you know, where they go, and how they're used.
Well, the short answer is they don't go very far, and they're not used very much. And I'll just give you an example. When I was at NYRA, and it was started before I was there, you know, we at least put out our financials monthly. It went up on the website, and everyone could see. You could see what purses were. You could see what they were prior period, year to date. But there was no takeout information, for example. You go to the website today at NYRA, and, you know, I'm still a big New York better, love NYRA. David O'Rourke was hired by me. He's the current president. So I'm not saying this to disparage them, but you can click on NYRA Financials. You go there, you'll see a blank page. But we need to go far beyond the financials. I mean, I would advocate that every racetrack ought to publish what their effective takeout rate is for every class of their customer. Let's look at the rebaters. Their average takeout rate is probably about 6%. On a good day, they actually probably make money. Before the rebate, by the way. These are all before rebates. Put the ADW number in there, and then put the general population betting. And so when we say NYRA has a 20% takeout, that's not really helpful. You really need to know what segments. So if you're a guy sitting in the grandstand at Saratoga, which I've been many, many times, you know, what are my chances? I'm not probably looking to get a 20% takeout. I'm probably effectively going to be in a 23 or 24% takeout, depending on what my bet is. And that's what I think the obligation is of the track to the people. So we've got to have a complete reset. You know, every ADW ought to be required, you know, to give the tracks very specific information on their customers. And one of the comments that arose, and I've heard this myself, and one of the readers said, you know, there are, you know, a number of places that are pari-mutuel, like Connecticut, that don't have racing, so they don't have they're not required to make a purse payment. Some ADWs have been known to give people addresses in states, which is much more friendly, because every state has a different takeout rate and a different set of rules, you know, for their wagering activity. So we've really got to just open things up and be accountable. And, you know, if I'm a track, I should have the ability on an annual basis to go in and, whether it's NYRA Bets, whether it's Twin Spires, whatever, and see exactly who's betting through that customer on my product. So, because we're not going to change any of this, you know, without some change of legislation potentially. But the track operators themselves have to realize that this pricing structure they have right now is not working for them. You don't go from $15 billion in handle to $10.9 billion in handle and stay alive for another 20 years.
And obviously some of that, you know, some of that business was lost, you know, for any number of reasons that, you know, included, you know, a financial upheaval. You know, this to some extent is a sport when it comes to the gaming that is driven by, you know, expendable income. I mean, there's, and I suppose, Charlie, stop on that for 1 second. It didn't occur to me to ask this until you mentioned that missing quote unquote revenue. Obviously, if the serious player and semi-serious player and weekend warrior and even casual player, if they're being ground away by, you know, by usurious takeout, and they, you know, the churn, as is often discussed, I mean, keeping enough money in players' hands, you know, to keep playing, if we're losing a certain percentage of that on a going basis, I mean, granted, things seem to have stabilized the last several years, but if we're losing those kinds of players, obviously, the maintenance of, of the 10 plus billion is in no small part, these giant customers. I guess we can't call them retail customers, right? I mean, they're wholesale customers.
Right.
I mean, that's a fair way to identify them, right? I mean, I'm a retail player. You're a retail player. Most of us listening are. And, you know, then there's professionals that are full-time players, you know, somebody like Paul Matisse. But, you know, the wholesale type, they're, you know, and you touched on this. I mean, they're negotiating there because of the volume they're bringing. They are getting, all these different advantages that is threatening the other 70%, give or take, of the ecosystem.
Yeah, I mean, make no mistake, you're right to refer to it in the manner you do. The computer-assisted wagerer, or I call them computer-robotic wagerers, it's not one smart guy with a slick computer and some slick numbers. These guys, or gals, I'm sure there are some, they have teams of mathematicians, and they have, they've looked at every race that they're going to bet on, and they've calculated their view about how that horse is going to do in that race, and they run models, and then they run models against the Will Pays or whatever, and that's how they can work. So there's that issue certainly, and one other thing, we don't know today how much robotic wagering is actually done because nobody discloses it. You know, so you hear people speculate, just like I did. Elite bets $1 billion a year out of our 10.9. You know, that could be $2 billion, and we don't know, and we don't know how that's being managed. But that's one side of it. Let's go all the way to the other side of it. Before I got involved in racing, and my first job was at the Daily Racing Forum back in, 1998, I was in the book publishing business. And for about 5 or 6 years, I ran a company called Little Round & Company. And we had home offices in Boston and offices in New York. So I'd go up to Boston 2 days a week, take the 6 o'clock shuttle, and I'd come back on Thursday night on the 7 o'clock shuttle. And the CFO was a horse player like I was. And so we'd cut out at about 4 o'clock, go over to Suffolk, and we'd bet the very end of the Gulfstream card. In the summer, it would still be Belmont and, of course, Santa Anita. We'd probably play those three tracks. And I probably went to Suffolk in those 5 years, 50, 60 times, something like that. Never bet a nickel on a Suffolk race. And the money I was betting, though, at that time, Naira was a 3 or 4% exported to Suffolk. So the track would get 2%. First count would get 2%. And the rest of the money, a little bit would go to the state, and the rest of the money would go to Suffolk. And Suffolk was a great little track. I loved it. It's too bad it's not there anymore. But the truth is, even the way that we ran the ADW business from the outset kept a lot of tracks in business and horsemen in business that were pretty marginal and, weren't not necessarily, what was really growing the business. So there are a lot of unintended consequences of a lot of these decisions that were made by tracks or that were made gee, I'll swap. I'm here at Oaklawn. I'll swap my signal for California. When I do this in, 2006 or seven, that's 3 points I'm not getting because I'm never going to get that California better. Well, those times have all changed. But the problem is our financial structure to support the better racing or to improve racing just doesn't exist, if that makes any sense.
Well, we touched last week on what had been a concerted effort that even started to swing back to, to the takeout and to how to better manage, the number just to make the pricing more attractive. How much discussion, Charlie? And I mentioned last week when you came to NYRA, you followed Barry Schwartz, who had been making concerted efforts to bring the takeout down on the whips on Win Play Show, and was making headway until the New York State Racing and Wagering Board they managed to put the brakes on it. And for people that, forget that from, 10, 12 years ago, I think you had gotten down to 14%, correct?
Correct.
And now back up in the 17 range. And
correct.
When it comes to the discussions, and one of the things that exasperates players has been the seeming lack of understanding, and you started the conversation today with kind of a reference to it about understanding the revenue stream and understanding betting. How often is the pricing structure being discussed as part of these, these management elements? I mean, folding in negotiations with the signal pricing and so forth. How much room is there? I mean, what is the mechanism that can better position the takeout structure industry wide to be competitive and to be attractive and to be reasonable? And of course, this gets in, Charlie, also to that famous term, optimal takeout, and the concern that no one really knows what that number is.
Well, you raise a brilliant point, and and if somebody would like to see our government in action, and just stay with me for a minute or two, but we talked a little bit last time we spoke about source market fees. Mm-hmm. And when simulcasting started, and it went state by state, and it still goes state by state, some provision, people argued, need to be made for the customer base around the racetrack. So source market fees would be 25, 50 miles. Anybody in that area that opens an account with another track or an ADW would pay a source market fee, which would normally be somewhere in the 2-3% range. And New York could never do it because and we didn't have source market fees when I was at NYRA, because you had, at that time, six individual OTBs. There's no New York OTB anymore. There were, I think, seven harness tracks, and there were four thoroughbred tracks, three NYRA tracks and Finger Lakes. And they just threw up their hands, so there weren't any source market fees. We felt, when I was there was no sense arguing about it because the OTBs and the harness tracks were always treated preferentially. And lo and behold, I was talking to Jeff Canizzo right after he announced that he was going over to NYRA and did a brilliant job working for the New York Breeders and a smart guy, and I think NYRA did a great thing to hire him. He told me they had started in New York a market origin credit. And if anybody wants a real lesson in how money gets whacked up in the state of New York for racing, go to the New York Gaming Commission and just click on market origin credits. And just, I've got the month of August here sitting in front of me. So there's total handle, allegedly. I say allegedly because, again, as we said, there's no audit. So whatever numbers are submitted are the numbers that, you know, they pay off of. So this past August, Saratoga, these ADW accounts, and it looks like there's about a dozen of them, generated $70 million in wagering activity. And they have a market origin fee of 5% in this case in New York. So the money that was up and available to be distributed was $3.5 million. And you go down through this, and you'd say, okay, these are New York residents betting through these ADWs, and they're the customer of the ADW, but they are a New York resident. And that's why this money comes back. So you'd think, okay, Saratoga, you would think that NYRA and NYRA Horsemen would get a pretty good chunk of that $3.5 million. Well, if you think that, you think wrong. The OTBs for the month of August collectively got $1.4 million. The harness tracks got $700,000. And NYRA got $350,000, which was the same amount of money that the parimutuel tax and the gaming commission got. So basically, NYRA got 10% of the money that was distributed as a result of what they call the market origin credits. So it's just, that's the problem in state government, is that there's a lot of hands out here, and it doesn't, you know, NYRA's, those are the wealthy guys, they got the good horses, you know, they don't need the money. Well, that's just not right. What's interesting, and I really don't know anything about this, Steve, but I happen to be cruising the internet on racing stuff, and there's a company called the Spectrum Gaming Group, which was just commissioned to do a huge gaming market study. And both for, I'm assuming that this is what Cuomo might have looked at, because the report was just done in January, right around the same time that he made the statement that they were going to, you know, start getting in the gaming business. But there's about 80 pages that talk about the thoroughbred and horse racing business. And they talk about heretical things like, you know, why do we need five different OTB operations with five HR departments and five this and five that? So I'm just, my next column may well be writing about what this is, because they talk about some pretty forward-looking things. I'm sure I'm not going to agree with everything, but the racing business needs a whole complete overhaul in how they think about their business today, because, you know, they backed into the rebaters. It seemed like a lot of money at the time. I think it's costing them customers and handle. And we can go down through all the how ADWs developed. You know, when you think that purses in the racetrack make less money from an ADW bet than the ADW does, and look at the cost structure of buying those horses and racing those horses versus having, you know, basically a big computer, that the capital costs are relatively small because the computers that are used to bet are people that use their own home computers. So anyway, my point is, there is no clear way that the racing industry collectively looks at what they're doing. And you have no better evidence than the fact the last time they looked at a wagering report, and is that report from 2004 by the NCRA. It's a great report. The problem is, if there were a dozen provisions that they talk about implementing, you know, if they did three of the 12, I'd be surprised. So we've got to have some kind of call to action, because the current structure is not incented to take care of their best customers. And their best customers are their loyal people. They aren't the people that are playing through rebaters.
How practical, and I can remember, when Lou Raffetto and Maryland tried, and this has been tried, you know, two or three different times now, and I think we understand, you know, you talk about kind of trying to reorient things, and MJC and Lou pulled out that Laurel meat that they were going to slash takeout. Canterbury did this as well, and you know, they were trying to, you know, gain some traction for the, you know, the concept that takeout reduction will, you know, will increase churn and will grow the business. And the lesson in both cases was that if it's done in a vacuum, if it's done in an isolated setting, just Canterbury, just Laurel, that there's no way to measure the impact, because the churn that, you know, that essentially stays with players that are utilizing that reduced takeout cost structure, there's no guarantee that they're going to churn it back right, you know, all into Laurel or Canterbury. And so even though Canterbury, for instance, was up 8% through their experiment, it wasn't enough to offset the reduction in revenue based on, you know, the old, you know, the previous season stakeout. And so it to some degree, it gives other racetrack executives, oh, see, reduced takeout doesn't work. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Incorrect. And so, I mean, here's people trying to do well-intentioned things, and it ends up, not that it backfires, because anybody that can see through, you know, that argument, you know, will counter it. But how practical, Charlie, is the idea of gaining uniform takeout at least across maybe across the whips, for instance, to gain, you know, to gain a industry wide target figure to, you know, to try to promote you know, movement in this direction? Is there, you know, is it possible to build a consensus in that regard?
Well, I'll tell you, just a quick thing on Canterbury, because I actually wrote about that. Eric Hallstrom was at that time the GM there, and he's a good friend of mine. And, you know, we wrote up in Thoroughbred Racing Commentary. One of his other good friends, a good friend of mine, Jim Costas, who runs the forum, you know Jim very well, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Eric was looking at the New York market thinking, well, I got to get my PPs in the forum or else no one's going to bet. Because, believe it or not, Canterbury, that runs only in the summer, runs a lot at night, on the weekends, has one of the, it's in the bottom five of racetracks in terms of distribution of their signal around the country. So, and on top of that, it pissed down rain for a lot of that summer. Mm. So it was an important and bold move. And frankly, it cost Eric his job, because when that, not long after it was over, Eric was on his way to the fairgrounds. So, but I think it gets to a bigger and more important point, which is I don't think the racetracks alone can solve this problem. And you made a really good point and an interesting point at the outset of your show today, talking about historical horse racing machines in Kentucky. And they have energized the entire industry there, the breeding industry, the owners, the tracks. I mean, Churchill's got a huge stake in, you know, the new track that they're building. They've got a huge stake in that former OTB parlor that they had that they built into a little casino. They bought Turfway Park, and they're rebuilding that. Keelan's involved with them, as you know. So I think that, again, referring back to my original article that we were talking about, there was a fellow, if you go down at the end and read one of the comments, said that he, 10 years ago, did a really extensive study about takeout and about distribution of the takeout monies and purses. And he was horrified. Said this is not a business that you'd want to be investing in, and I'm not sure how long it's going to be around. And he had some very important owners, and he went to the tracks and tried to talk to them about where ADW was going to go, where rebaters were going to go, and he couldn't get anybody's attention. It's a really smart article. He doesn't say a lot about how he would have gone about it, but I think we're at the point where we've got to get the industry somehow together to do something. And, you know, the only organization right now that's showed some ability, because they've got some money and they've got some smart, and people have different views about them, but the Jockey Club is probably the most progressive and most important industry right now. You know, getting that legislation, which is going to clean up, you know, the cheating in racing is huge. They're probably one of the biggest funders and supporters of the Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance. But somehow we've got to get TOBA, we've got to get the tracks, we've got to get the Jockey Club to look at the various component parts. And because keep doing what we're doing is not going to get it done. That makes sense.
Yeah, and yeah, well, it does. And you know, in the meantime, I mean, there has been, and as I mentioned, when it comes to, you know, the advent of the Pick Five, I mean, that has been a, you know, a runaway success. I mean, we can't pretend that, you know, there hasn't been offerings that are specifically, you know, to show a consciousness of being priced right, but there needs to be obviously a much wider initiative and you know an ongoing attempt to bring this in line. And you know the messaging obviously, Charlie, is one thing that is hurt too. I mean, I would say that the horse playing community is, you know, really receptive. I mean, look at what went on Sunday with Sam Houston. And granted, you know, they promoted the daylights out of the big card on Sunday, and you know, we're happy to participate in that. But yep, their ongoing efforts, and this dates back to Andrea Young's tenure, they've been consistent in their message and trying to drive home a point that, you know, we're committed to, you know, recognizing the horse player and keeping the, you know, the takeout numbers as low as possible. And I suppose that by doing that, I mean, they're making their signal as their handle increases, they're making, you know, they're giving themselves more leeway to negotiate, you know, better rates for themselves. Indiana is, you know, you mentioned Eric, and Indiana.
Yeah, that's where Eric is now. Right.
I mean, off of a spectacular year. And right. So, you know, there's individual examples of success and of the consistency of the messaging that, you know, can be, I hope, used as, you know, as a, as a model, I suppose. I mean, and, you know, and it's funny because in Texas, all it took to kind of reorient their business statewide, you know, they're, you know, they're an island surrounded by gaming states,
right?
By aggressive gaming states, Louisiana, Oklahoma, and New Mexico. And all it took to improve the landscape was somebody clever enough to think of that taxation system, you know, basically, you know, going to, you know, to Austin and saying, you know, let's siphon off the tax revenue that comes from equine sport and funnel it back in, and you know, in lieu of being able to compete with gaming money, this at least, you know, is something. Maryland had the same, a similar story, just getting that little stipend that they're getting from gaming. And it's been enough. Yeah, it's not like, you know, I know people, this is a different topic we could actually talk about because you were in place as the, you know, as the revenue from Aqueduct, you know, began to finally.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, being held.
I mean, my personal account was $103 million in 2011, and 2012 was $163 million. We had a little bump there. You're right. But, you know, I want to stay with your point because you're making some good points, because there's companies and areas that where they've been smart and progressive, but there are other areas, and I'm going to give you a good example of it, where people have been fortunate and they've taken care of it, and in April of this past year was a good example of it. I think during April there were five tracks that were running.
Right.
And one of the five tracks was Fauner Park. And I don't know the fellow who's president, but he's obviously a smart entrepreneur. He got Bayer to go on their simulcast thing and do some, you know, some picks on a particular day, and they were handling, I think they only ran historically a 6-week meet or something,
right,
like that, the month of April. And their average handle, you know, daily handle was like $600,000 a day. And they all of a sudden found themselves, because they were one of the few signals, they found themselves doing like $3.5 million a day.
Right.
And the point of my story is, so that this entrepreneur promoting his track has the ability to run an additional 3 weeks. He goes to the ADW companies. He didn't name which ones, but I assume all of them. And they said, look, I can stay open for another month or so, but I'm only getting 3% from you guys. So when $2 million are bet on me, I got $30,000 for me and $30,000 for the horsemen, you know, and you guys got the rest. So what he got was an agreement that the ADWs would go to 5% for that period, whatever it was, 3 or 4 weeks.
Right, the extra.
But only on the condition, when they come back next year, they go back to 3%. So, you know, I guess he said, if that's the best offer, I'll take that. But, you know, that to me doesn't show much of a partnership between the goal of the ADWs in regards to their own finances or in regards to working with racing. That's the problem that we got to solve.
Hmm. Well, and Chris Katulak is, and we were in constant conversation, you know, through the meet with Chris, and
I've never met him. I heard him a little bit, but he's a smart guy, huh?
He's terrific and gung ho, and you know, would have you know, been as eager and as you know, outgoing about Foner, even if things had not, you know, even if the pandemic hadn't happened and all that attention came their way. But once it did, you know, I absolutely needed to take advantage, you know, especially knowing as we, you know, as we did afterward, how difficult things were in Grand Island, Nebraska, period, because of the meatpacking plants. And it was miraculous what Foner was able to do. And it is a little disheartening that and seemingly negotiations in bad faith that they would say that you know that the signal has to go back to 3% next year, you know, knowing that next year the assumption is that, you know, Santa Anita is going to be running and Aqueduct, right, and everybody that went dark during, you know, March and April and into May, that, you know, they're going to be running. And so your signal becomes, you know, it goes back to C track status. And, you know, that's just not, that doesn't do anybody any good. And it doesn't, it also doesn't show any foresight and long-term thinking as to the needs of the business on a widespread basis. And I used the term ecosystem earlier, and that's what this is. I mean, this is the entire industry is interdependent on each other. And so, you know, everybody being out for themselves, essentially, and, you know, operating with that thinking, is really probably the root of our problem, collectively.
Listen, I think you're 100% right, because just think about the math. And I don't know what state taxes would be involved, but the simple math is the guy's takeout's probably somewhere 20 or a little bit north of that, and he's got to pay some taxes and whatever. And I'm not even sure there's a source market fee there. But anyway, so the ADWs are getting a signal for 3 points out of 20, and he's trying to run a racetrack. So he gets a little good luck and hard work, gets a lot of attention for his outfit. And what's the ADWs? Yeah, we'll take advantage of your good fortune, but fuck you. We're not going to fix you next year, you know?
Yep.
So it's dog-eat-dog in that regard. There is no collaboration, and that's what needs to change. The owners have to realize the tracks are important to them, the trainers are important to them, the jocks, the customers, the ADWs. We've got to have a business that's growing.
Well, Charlie, lost you there right at the end there. I lost you the last 10 seconds.
I'm sorry. I was walking around in my... I'm getting worked up. I had to move around. So,
well, yeah, let me tell you.
Okay, now
it much better. But you made me laugh because you know, I keep referring to the Our Industry conversations with Satish. You turned into Satish there for a couple of seconds.
Well, anyway,
it's terrific. We'll pull up here another, you know, 45 minutes that is well spent. And, you know, with each passing conversation, there's other things that are being introduced. I mean, I referenced Crims earlier, and I don't think anybody out in the industry that isn't involved in the internecine portions of, you know, of the financing, has any idea how settlement works in this game at all. And that would be a worthwhile conversation. I also, Charlie, have got, you know, some other people that are going to sit in and, you know, I heard from Pat Cummings, and Pat, you know, basically hung on every word last week, and I'm sure, you know, we'll dissect this as well. You know, I want Pat to contribute, and, you know, there's so many other people that, you know, have these issues, you know, as central to their, you know, to their dedication to improving the, you know, the landscape overall. So,
well, you know, just, I don't want to take much more of your time, but
go ahead.
It's very interesting you mentioned Crims, because, you know, a lot of people don't realize they were set up in California to basically be the settlement business for the state of California. And Mark Thurman, who's been there a long time, we went to Mark. I went to Mark because Crims had come in and put in a whole financial reporting system based on wagering. And I was sitting with Nick Nicholson. This goes back a long time. When I'd first come to NAIRA, he had just started at Keeneland as president. And he showed me these reports and this data, and I was going crazy. So I called up Thurman. I got him to come to New York. And we had a half-baked settlement system. He put in a settlement system for us. We then had a big problem in purchasing, and we bought a lot of stuff. NAIRA's a big company. He set that up for us. There's probably no better inside financial guy in this industry than Mark Thurman that runs Crims.
Yep.
So, and I think those are the kind of people that we need to get engaged and work on some problem solving here.
Well, just getting the topics out, you know, into the light. I'm going to, what's the saying? Sunlight, is it sunlight is the best sanitizer? just getting the topics out for discussion and promoting, whether people, agree with, I don't think anybody would disagree with the concept of trying to improve the pricing of the product out there, but the urgency is one thing that the industry has really struggled with, and of course we spent a decade wasting time arguing about Lasix. That's a frustration that I isn't going to go away anytime soon. I mean, instead of really talking about the core issues, the core business, pretending that eliminating Lasix is going to somehow help the business was just laughable. Just like getting rid of steroids. Oh, people aren't betting on the horses because of steroids. Oh, really? Okay, we eliminated steroids. The business grow a lot, did it? Ridiculous. I'll sidetrack myself, Charlie. But just getting these topics discussed and making people aware will go, I hope, go a long way toward trying to motivate some wider discussion, agreement, and action.
Well, I completely agree with that. You mentioned Pat Cummings. Pat sent me a note because I had mentioned his very good article in my article, and I've got a call with Pat tomorrow. So we got to get some people to carry the ball, and there's a lot of balls to be carried. So, and I'm sure, Steve, you'll do your part, and I'll help in any way I can.
Outstanding. Charlie Hayward, everybody, and I'll send the link out again if you didn't hear last week's conversation. Of course, it's in the archives, but if you haven't read Charlie's piece, you got to go there first, and that'll be a jumping-off point, and we'll continue to discuss industry future with Charlie Hayward. Charlie, have a good week. We'll talk next week.
Okay, Steve. Thanks for the opportunity. Really appreciate it.
Not at all. We appreciate the time. Charlie Hayward, everybody, and 20 plus in. Let's take the break, and I think I solved the issue about the 10:30 to 11 because we went right through 10. So let's get Sid Fernando in here. Second half coming up. Sire Watch Pedigree Focus brought to you by Hill & Dale, and actually got a full slate with Sid because I do want to get some historical pedigree appreciation in for Narrate, who produced Preach and Yarn, who got Pulpit and Tale of the Cat. So I'll let Sid riff on that. I know he'll enjoy it, and I'm sure he's got some personal ties and anecdotes. And then, of course, we'll look at the pedigrees of both the winners of the Preps, Medina Spirit, the Britannico, and the Tawny. Greatest Honor. Back after this, coming up on the second half at the races, Sirius XM. Stay with us.
The latest races. racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only three states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at PABred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
HorseBills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through HorseBills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the HorseBills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. HorseBills.com. Toll free number 888-938-4643.
Sirius XM Sports presents